Thank you all for coming. This is a strange format, but I think I explained some of it last night to some of you. I hope it's going to work out today. It's basically we're trying to create a conversation here to discuss this extraordinarily important topic. We are, as you can see, filming this. This is a Science Network production. The Science Network has its headquarters here at the Salk Institute. And if you look inside the program on the inside front cover, you'll see a little very brief description about what we'll do. The idea is to build a multimedia programming platform that will be a trusted destination for those concerned with science and its impact on society. We're also doing this in conjunction with the Crick Jacobs Center here at the Salk. And there's a couple of people I'd like to recognize in the audience who, if they're here. One is, oh yes, they're sitting at the back there extraordinarily. One is Rita Bronowski. Rita, good morning. How are you? I suppose if there's any reason, one reason that I could lay to actually standing here doing this morning, it's watching The Ascent of Man. In England growing up as a kid and just thinking what an extraordinary production that Jacob Bronowski did and thinking, I wonder if one could make a living doing that sort of thing. Looks really impressive. So I was completely taken by what Bruno did there and got to know the family, and this is a sort of a full circle for me to be back here at the Salk Institute, where, of course, Bruno came and was a deputy director and instigated some programs which were very much about the communication of science, the two cultures, and the intersection of science and society issues. So this is, to me, the place to be doing this kind of a program, and it's sort of a tribute to Jacob Bronowski and to Rita that we're doing this. And also, of course, to Francis Crick, one of the first people I met in coming here in 1976 to talk to people about Bronowski, in fact, was Francis. Sadly, no longer with us, but again, you'll see the description inside the front cover about the Crick Jacobs Center, and we're extremely happy that Odile Crick is here this morning as well. We're going to do. Let me just explain the format. We're covering three basic themes. The first one is the clash of cultures, religion and science. Is this, in fact, a zero-sum game, or is there some compatibilist position that we can find? The second broad theory, the broad thread, is can we be good without God? So how do you get morality? Is there some evolutionary explanation, or do we actually have to have a religious explanation? And the third strand is, if not God, then what? What do we do in terms of these, what people have called spirituality? What do we do about meaning? How do we talk about purpose? What do you do, in fact, as we say in the program here, can science help us create a new rational narrative as poetic and powerful as those that have traditionally sustained societies? Those are the three basic topics that we'll be dealing with. We will be dealing with topic one to begin with, which is the clash of cultures, and Steven Weinberg will lead off on that. And then after the break, we'll go on to the third one, the if not God, then what, which is actually a natural segue. We'll hopscotch over the morality issue and do that this afternoon when Richard Dawkins arrives, which will be about 11 o'clock. Just one thought. There was a terrorist plot, an extremist religious plot uncovered on November the 4th, last night, in fact, in London. The perpetrators had put a huge amount of gunpowder under the Houses of Commons. And there was the leader was, in fact, they managed to get in there. I don't know if you know this story, but they'd managed to get in there because there was the space under the Houses of Commons was for rent. And you could just go and rent space under there. So these people cheerfully wheeled in great crates of gunpowder and so on and so forth. Somebody was a weasel and let the story out, and the person who was the ringleader, a man called Guy Fawkes, was apprehended. This is in England when I was growing up. Today, November the 5th, is gunpowder, is Guy Fawkes Day, gunpowder plot, when this group of Catholic extremists tried to blow up the Houses of Commons. So this kind of clash of cultures, if you like, clash of religions, has been going on for a long time. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to solve it all in these 2.5 days, but I certainly hope that in the Enlightenment tradition we'll be able to throw some more light on it. With that, the other thing I'd like to say is that I'm not going to spend a lot of time with honorifics and descriptions of who people are. You can get most of this from the program, which explains the whole story. Steven Weinberg, very briefly though, is Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Texas, Austin. And for me, what is most important is the extraordinary things that he's written. I think his books are just a wonderful example of the combination of the two cultures. They're elegant, they're taut, they're incise, and I welcome him to this podium.
Well, as shown by the fact that we're here on a beautiful day inside talking about these things, the tension between science and religion, this old problem, is still with us. In the United States, it has surfaced to the greatest extent in arguments over the theory of evolution. According to one poll taken by the Pew Foundation, 62% of Americans don't believe humans evolved from earlier life forms. This has been a big political issue in Kansas and Ohio and other places. Perhaps because of the way this issue has appeared politically in the United States, many people talk about the conflict between science and religion as simply a matter of misguided biblical literalism, and that the conflict can be resolved. Many people think the conflict can be resolved simply by recognizing different scopes for science and religion. This was expressed by Galileo in a letter to Christina of Lorraine. He said, "The intention of the Holy Ghost is to teach us how one goes to heaven, not how heaven goes." He was actually quoting a cardinal of the church, the Vatican librarian, Cardinal Baronius, in saying this. So this is an old opinion that as long as we recognize the separate magisteriums of science and religion, no problem. Stephen Gould and Freeman Dyson, both friends of mine, have argued this. They put it simply, science deals with fact, religion deals with values, end of the story. And many religious people, especially in the West, would agree, and especially in the main denominations, the mainline denominations. And the Templeton Foundation is ready with lots of cash for people who will support this point of view. I don't think it's so easy. I think that the tension between science and religion has deeper roots than an argument over biblical literalism. I think that religion and science will go on for some time having negative effects on each other. For one, it's clear biblical literalism is not the only problem, because it's an ancient problem that has been met and solved many times in the past. There was a time in the history of the early church when some church fathers read verses in the book of Genesis and other parts of the Bible as indicating that the earth was flat, and hence rejected the existing Greek understanding that the earth is a sphere. This was resolved. These people really didn't care very much what the shape of the earth was. And by the high Middle Ages, it was generally accepted among educated Christians that the earth is a sphere. And in fact, Dante found the core of the spherical Earth a very convenient place to stash sinners. That was once a serious issue has in fact become a joke. A friend of mine, Adrian Malott, a physicist at the University of Kansas, has formed a Flat Earth Society to demand the teaching of the Flat Earth theory as an alternative to the spherical Earth theory in Kansas public schools so that children will have the opportunity to make up their own mind about this scientific issue, obviously in mockery of the intelligent design movement. I think there are at least four other reasons for the conflict between science and religion. And I should say, in talking about religion, I am not talking about observance, morality, or rhapsodic spirituality. I'm not talking about the part of religion that has no cognitive content, what Susan Sontag called piety without content. I'm talking about religion as a system of belief, because that's where the conflict arises. First of all, science has historically downgraded human beings from a central role in creation. Nobody cares whether the Earth is a sphere, but they cared very much that it's not at the center of the universe. After all, this is the stage of a great cosmic drama of sin and salvation, and shouldn't it be center stage? Of course, this led to the problems that Galileo had in adopting the Copernican theory, and these problems lasted well into the 19th century at Spanish universities like the University of Salamanca. Theory of evolution, of course, is an obvious example. It treats human beings as another animal species that has developed through millennia of breedings and eatings to be what it is, not as part of the working out of a divine plan. As we learn more and more about the universe, science sees less and less sign of any special role for human beings, either in the laws of nature themselves or in the history of the universe, of the sort that's imagined by traditional religion. First, there was the discovery that the Earth is not at the center of the solar system. Then the solar system is not at the center of creation. It's just one of many in our galaxy. Our galaxy is not unique. That was discovered in the as late as the 1920s, that the universe has billions of galaxies extending in all directions. And in recent years, through developments in the theory of the very early universe, in particular the theory of chaotic inflation due to André Linde, we now have a picture which is, I would say, plausible but not yet well established, that our Big Bang, this enormous firmament of galaxies expanding in all directions, is just one episode in a much larger multiverse in which Big Bangs, or maybe I should say not so Big Bangs, are popping off all the time, world without end. And it may be that in this multiverse, some of the things that we call the constants of nature vary from one part of the multiverse to another. There were discoveries in string theory recently that lend a good deal of plausibility to that. But although I must say, I wouldn't defend this as something that is well-established science. Well, that's the first thing, that science downgrades humans for a central role. The second is that science makes religious explanations unnecessary. There used to be something called natural theology, seeking in the observed world evidences of divine intervention. And in particular, it was felt that only divine intervention could explain the wonderful capabilities of human beings. The classic statement of that was by Archdeacon William Paley in his 1802 book, Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity. And indeed, I just happened to read a biography of Cardinal Manning, who led the Roman Catholic Church in England, and he credited this with converting him to the Christian faith. Well, we all know that that argument was invalidated by the theory of evolution through natural selection of Darwin and Wallace. And now, with the work of modern evolutionary biologists, even the aspects of human life that seem most spiritual, that seem most evidences of a divinely created soul, our love for one another, our sense of loyalty, of honesty, of charity, appear to have, and I don't know how well accepted this is, many of you know more about this than I do, but appear to have evolutionary explanations in terms, again, of an unplanned evolution through natural selection. Some people find this very hard to swallow. Even an excellent scientist like Francis Collins has said that this sort of argument, evolution, will never explain special human attributes, such as the knowledge of the moral law and the universal search for God. Well, some evolutionary biologists think it will. We can't prove that God never intervenes because the world is too complicated a place. But increasingly, as the centuries pass, we see less and less need to assume any divine intervention. The famous opinion expressed by the Marquis de Laplace to Napoleon when Laplace explained the working of the solar system according to Newton's laws, and Napoleon asked, where in this is there a place for God? And Laplace said, sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. The fact, in this way, through the ordinary workings of science, we can explain things like the fact that the Earth is such a comfortable place. A colleague of mine at the University of Texas, some kind of spiritual advisor to, or at any rate, an advisor to George Bush, Martin Olasky, had a column in our local newspaper in which he explained that the marvelous suitability of the Earth for life was some kind of evidence for divine benevolence. And of course, that would be a good argument, in fact, if the Earth were the only planet in the universe. But with billions of planets in the universe, it's natural that some of them are suitable for life. And it's only on the planets that are suitable for life that there are people asking questions about it. In the same way, in the different parts of the multiverse, if indeed it's true that the constants of nature vary from one part to another, then this picture provides a natural explanation of the fact that the laws of nature are suitable for the appearance of life. In many parts of the multiverse, they may not be. The power of this kind of reasoning has been recognized in a rather infamous article in the New York Times by Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, the Archbishop of Vienna, in July 2005. His article concludes as follows. Now, at the beginning of the 21st century, faced with scientific claims like neo-Darwinism and the multiverse hypothesis in cosmology, invented to avoid the overwhelming evidence for purpose and design found in modern science, the Catholic Church will again defend human nature by proclaiming that the immanent design evident in nature is real. Scientific theories that try to explain away the appearance of design as the result of chance and necessity are not scientific at all, but as John Paul put it, an abdication of human intelligence. Well, I have to say that I was gratified by this to some extent, because we physicists feel that you evolutionary biologists get all the fun in this political argument about the role of science. And at least Cardinal Schönborn recognizes that work in cosmology can also be interesting. I would say that although, as shown by this statement, there is opposition to specific scientific ideas within Western Christianity, there's not really an opposition to the idea of science itself, only to some of its conclusions. I think this is different in the world of Islam. And it's really quite tragic because, as we know, Islam led the world in science in the 9th century at a time, the famous statement by Philip Hitti in his book about the Arabs that the caliphs Al-Mamun and Al-Rashid were delving into Greek philosophy and science at a time when Charlemagne and his nobles were struggling with the art of writing their names. Many of the scientists of this great period of Islamic science were rather non-religious. Some of them, like Razi's, actually hostile to religion, although some, I must say, like Al-Tusi and Avicenna, were quite religious. But it was a mixed picture. But then there was a reaction against science in the Islamic world in the 12th century. And it was not a reaction so much against any one particular conclusion of science as against the very idea of laws of nature. Because it was felt that the laws of nature put God's hands in chains. This was particularly the view of an influential philosopher, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, who wrote a book, The Incoherence of the Philosophers. He rejected the idea of the laws of nature. He explained, for example, that if you put a piece of cotton in the fire and it turns black and smolders, it's not because of the heat, it's because God wants it to turn black and smolder. Everything is a special occasion for the will of God. Whether it was al-Ghazali's influence or whatever, or perhaps the depression due to military defeats in Spain, Islamic science really ended by the end of the 12th century. And today we have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt that calls for an end of education in science. I had a dear friend, now no longer with us, Abdus Salam, a Pakistani, although like all scientists I know of Muslim origin who do significant work, he was educated and works in the West, not in Muslim countries. He tried for many years to get the oil-rich states of the Persian Gulf to invest in universities, including science education, and he found that they were quite open to the idea of technology, but tried to divorce it from fundamental science, because they felt that fundamental science would pose problems for their religious faith. My feeling is they were probably right about that. Well, I've mentioned three areas of hostility, that the laws of nature put God's hands in chains, they downgrade humans from the central, science downgrades humans from a central role, and it provides alternative explanations. But there's another one which may be the deepest area of conflict between science and religion, although I don't think it gets mentioned so often, and that is in the method of approach to truth. Religion largely relies on authority. It may be the authority of sacred texts, as in Sunni Islam and Protestant Christianity, or texts together with religious leaders who are divinely inspired to interpret them, like Shiite Islam and Roman Catholicism. We don't have anything like that in the world of science. I want to make a clear distinction. We do have heroes. As scientists, we have enormous respect for. But they're not authorities to whom we go for solution of scientific problems. For example, in my field, certainly Einstein is the greatest hero of the 20th century. But no one today arguing about the theory of gravitation would settle the issue by referring back to Einstein's papers of 1915, 1916, Today, it's understood that any reasonably good graduate student understands general relativity better than Einstein did. We have learned, we have progressed, and so in science, we don't have prophets. We have heroes, but not prophets. And I think that another difference in the approach to truth is that we try hard in science to stamp out the influence of wishful thinking, whereas so much of religious thought seems to be nothing else. I must believe in the afterlife because how could I face it if my life was going to terminate at death? The one thing that science cannot do, however, any more than religion can, is to justify itself. As David Hume understood long ago, you cannot use scientific arguments as a justification for science itself because that's circular. It's a moral choice between the methods of approaching truth of religion, the reverence for authority, the search for beliefs that will make us happy, and the more austere, self-reliant approach to truth of religion. For me, the moral choice is clear, but it is a moral choice and one that can't be, I think, argued about rationally. So what do we do about this conflict? There are those whose views about religion are not very different from my own, but who nevertheless feel that we should try to damp down the conflict, that we should compromise it. For example, Steve Gould, and he can correct me if I'm wrong because he's here, Larry Krauss, feel that it's most important to maintain the integrity of scientific teaching, and we should try to enlist the mainline religions who are often perfectly comfortable with teaching Darwinism, say, in school, as our allies, and not step on their toes by talking about a confrontation between science and religion. Ed Wilson, another dear friend, wants to enlist the mainline religious denominations as allies in the defense of the environment. I respect their views, and I understand their motives, and I don't condemn them, but I'm not having it. To me, the conflict between science and religion is more important than these issues of science education or even environmentalism. I think the world needs to wake up from its long nightmare of religious belief, and anything that we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact in the end be our greatest contribution to civilization. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Would you mind taking a
chair? Sure.
And since you invoked Lawrence Krauss, perhaps we'll bring him up. I just wanted to say a couple of things while you come ahead, Lawrence. It's fine. Lawrence Krauss is the director of the Center of Education, Research and Cosmology in Astrophysics at Case Western Reserve University, and has done a lot of communication of science. I just wanted to make a couple of points there. We'll get on to some of the religion stuff later. And the Islamic point, Steve, that we actually emailed on this, the whole notion of Al-Ghazali, who in some sense was responsible for the spread of fundamentalism in Islam, was in fact a Sufi. And there is now a great call in the Islamic community, as I read it, to point out that it's not just some monolithic faith, that in fact there's huge numbers of sects. And that what is required is for these various sects to go back to their original roots and start expressing themselves away again and getting away from just the extreme fundamentalist position that's now taken control of it. And there was a column in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by Nicholas Kristof in which he said that what was perhaps was required at this point, and I'm not endorsing this or for or against, but he said that perhaps what we needed was a kind of an Islamic reformation and a Muslim Luther, which is an interesting concept. It's something for you to think about, and we'll come back to that a little bit later. But in the interim,
could I just say that Al-Ghazali was a philosopher before he was a Sufi. He was a student of Greek philosophy, and then he became a Sufi. And he really followed very much
the same career path as Augustine, who was also enamored of Greek philosophy and then turned his back on it.
Great, thank you.
But the Christianity recovered from that, and Islam hasn't.
All right, so let's hear Lawrence Krauss.
Okay, good. When Roger asked me last night to speak after Steve, I knew I wouldn't be able to compete in ideas, so I decided I'd have pictures. I wasn't quite sure what Steve would talk about, but I do want to talk about the conflict between science and religion and argue that that by focusing on this conflict, that scientists not only demean religion, which I think is the intent of a number of them, but demean science. So let me argue that we are, in fact, that Steve gave a wonderful history of the conflict of science and religion, but it isn't all ancient history. And there's lots of recent examples. This was an example in 2001 in Afghanistan, back when the Taliban were sort of our allies. This is a conflict between archaeology and religion. This is one of the famous Buddhas, which the Taliban destroyed, a beautiful, incredible, almost 2,000-year-old statues of incredible importance to civilization. But their religious belief at the time suggested that no likenesses of human beings should be portrayed. So they wanted to destroy all statues in Afghanistan. They didn't manage to do that, but unfortunately, they did manage to destroy that. At the same time, in this country, there were conflicts, and this is one of my favorites. This was Tom DeLay from your state, Steve, who has a degree in biology, which always amazes me, who put into the congressional record that the Columbine school shootings occurred in part, quote-unquote, because our school systems teach our children that they're nothing but glorified apes who have evolutionized out of some primordial mud. Okay, this is the then House Majority Leader. This is a clear conflict between science and religion, and it is not theoretical in any way. It's very real, and I unfortunately have to waste a lot of my time on this very real conflict that's happening nowadays. And it's been my here's some literature by groups who have been against evolution. Was that this is a pointer? Great, thanks. So this is quite clear, right? And they're quite straightforward about it. In fact, I think Steve would argue that indeed this is. I don't know whether he'd argue that he's motivated by Satan so much, but or the sciences, but that in fact that evolution is part of science should aim at the bedrock of Christianity. And you see here that the point is that evolution is responsible in this picture for all of the sins of humanity, everything from awful humanism to divorce, euthanasia, homosexuality, pornography, abortion, racism, etc. And this really, for me, represents the problem of focusing on the conflict. Because I view why I, as a physicist, have gotten involved in this is kind of interesting. I view evolution as a straw man. It's really, this conflict that you see here is really based on a fear of science. A fear that in fact, Steve has argued in some sense, is a real fear.
Okay.
But a fear that because science, in principle, not only replaces, potentially can replace God, but more importantly, I think, a fear of the fact that science doesn't explicitly mention God must mean, therefore, that science is immoral at its basis. And therefore, because it's immoral, it must be wrong. So because science doesn't explicitly include God, it must therefore be wrong, and it's an a priori argument, and therefore we have to change the way science is done. And evolution is just one example. The real goal in Kansas and other places, in Ohio, and in your state very soon, I guarantee you, because this is a well-funded effort, is to change the teaching of science itself. That science, which attempts to explain natural phenomena by natural effects by natural causes, is itself intrinsically wrong. That God has to be an explicit part of the equation. Now, let me talk about science enriching faith and quote one of my heroes. So Steve has said a number of things I like about science religion, but this is particularly important, I think, that science does not make it impossible to believe in God. It just makes it possible to not believe in God, and that's really important because as he indicated, without science, everything is a special act. Nothing has any, everything is a miracle. When you have science, you suddenly can explain things based on natural causes. But it's the first sentence, I think, that's very important. And that, I think, is what we have to recognize. And where I will disagree strongly with several people, with Richard, Dawkins will speak later, I think that, in fact, science does not make it impossible to believe in God, and we should recognize that fact and live with it. And, in fact, stop being so pompous about it. That, for better or worse, science itself, the existence of science itself, cannot disprove the existence of God. But science itself can provide a paradigm and a prototype for understanding the world and dealing with problems of humanity that might. And the key example that I want to give is actually one I used from a New York Times piece I wrote, which actually caused Cardinal Schönborn to get so upset that he wrote in response, which amazed me, because this was a piece where I argued that the Catholic Church was okay with evolution. And he got offended by that statement. But the example actually wasn't from evolution, it was from cosmology, and involved Georges Lemaître, who was a Belgian priest, who was one of the first people to actually understand that Einstein's general relativity predicted a Big Bang. Einstein didn't. Einstein thought the universe was static and eternal, and he derided, in fact, Lemaître, as he did in many cases people who disagreed with him early on. The good aspect is that he eventually realized Lemaître was right. But so when Lemaître pointed this out, that one of the predictions of general relativity was that there was a beginning of the universe, Pope Pius at the time got very excited and wrote a public statement saying science had proved Genesis. Okay? Now, what did Lemaître do? He was a priest at the time, and always was. He wrote to the Pope and said, stop saying that. Okay? And he said, you have no right to say that. You can take this, if you wish, to mean that science has proved Genesis to be correct, but you can also take it, this is a scientific theory, and it can be tested, and it stands on its own as science. What you take from it depends upon your metaphysical or religious background. You could take from it to be that it proves Genesis, or you could take from it to be that you don't need God at all, that the laws of physics will describe the universe right back to the beginning. What you take from it is your personal belief, and the science is independent of that belief. And I think that's very important, because the Big Bang is true whether or not you believe in God. Evolution happened whether or not you believe in God. And so I think that what we should focus on, in fact, is ways that science can, in fact, if you wish, enrich faith by moving us, for some of us who are not people of faith, and I'm not, by moving us beyond faith. That science can be used as an example of how to understand the world in a good way, in a positive way, instead of a negative way. That science teaches us to oppose blind, unquestioning belief. As Steve said, there are no scientific authorities. There are scientific experts, but no scientific authorities. It can inform faith in lots of ways. In particular, it's very important that we don't respect all religious sensibilities. I think we need to respect people's philosophical notions in general, unless those notions are wrong. And what I mean by, and the great thing about science is that there's some things that are wrong. In fact, that's what makes science unique. Unambiguously, we can say what's wrong. We can't say what's right unambiguously, but we can say what's wrong unambiguously. And that's why we make progress. The Earth isn't 6,000 years old. It's wrong. If you have to believe that to believe in God, you better re-examine your belief in God. The sun didn't stand still in the sky in the Old Testament, but we can use it in other areas. I actually presented a slide at a meeting of a bunch of very faithful people, where it's kind of weird that I'm here for balance, because at that meeting I guess I was viewed as an extremist. But where I said homosexuality is not an abomination. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I could say science can inform religion in two ways. First of all, that homosexuality occurs naturally in various species. So it's certainly not an abomination in nature. But more importantly, science can say, well, if you believe that because of the fact that you're literally reading from the Old Testament, then you have to, it's all or nothing. Then you have to accept the fact that you're allowed to kill your children if they disobey you or sell your wife into slavery if she's not politically appropriate or whatever. In fact, you have to say that women are not subservient chattel, as is the case in the Old Testament and in many religious documents. And if not to just offend Judeo-Christian religious sensibilities, the Kennewick man was not a Numitilla Indian. Okay? And it was an offense to me when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers held onto that skeleton. If you don't know, this was a 9,000-year-old skeleton that was discovered in the Columbia River on Umatilla Indian land. And it was interesting because it was claimed that this skeleton had Caucasian features. In fact, if you put skin on him, he'd look somewhat like Patrick Stewart. But and it was a fascinating question. But for many years, scientists weren't allowed to study the skeleton because the Umatilla Indians said, this is on our land, and therefore it's one of our ancestors, and we believe the earth is 5,000 years old, and this is 9,000 years old, and we want to keep this for ourselves. And it's just ludicrous, in fact. And the Kennewick man had much genetic relationship to an Umatilla Indian as they did to me, and it's ridiculous to respect those kind of nonsensical sensibilities. And we have to emphasize that these documents are historical documents. So we can enrich faith by pointing out what's nonsense. But in particular, I spent a lot of time talking to scientists about teaching. And this, I believe, is the biggest mistake that any teacher can make, which is to assume the students are interested in what they have to say. It sounds trite, but it's absolutely true. You have to sell. Teaching is selling. And science is selling. And it's, in fact, it's seduction. If you want to educate people, you have to go to where they are and reach out to where they're coming from. And if you want to educate people, attacking them is not going to educate them at all. And I think most of us here, I think Steve and I would certainly agree that what we want to do is educate. We want to explain to people the wonders of nature. But if we want to make them receptive to it, we have to understand where they're coming from. In fact, this I decided to quote someone else. In this case, I quoted myself. This was a review of mine of Richard Dawkins' book that just came out. That my review just came out in Nature, and I think that's true. I think that that the strategy of focusing on telling people what not to believe is less compelling than positively demonstrating how the wonders of nature can suggest a world without God that is nevertheless both complete and wonderful. If you believe that and want to convince people of that, focus on what is so incredible and marvelous and fantastic about the universe, and not on what people shouldn't believe in. And in fact, in this sense, I think scientists have responsibility. And scientists and physicists are the worst. I think we're the most obnoxious of the bunch, potentially. But because we, well, anyway.
No, biologists.
I knew you were going to say that. But science has been so successful, I think many scientists act like, we know what's good for you, and we're going to explain what's good for you. And that approach immediately turns people off, and in fact is, in my mind, responsible for a lot of the public reaction against science. Not just the fear that science will undermine their belief system, but the fact that scientists are claiming that that basically people are stupid, and that we can tell you what to believe. And I happen to think that is not, it actually demeans science, as well as demeaning religion. That, in fact, science does not encompass the entirety of human intellectual experience, and we can't pretend it does. And there are things of vital importance to people that have nothing to do with rationality. And they're profoundly important in a large part of people's lives, and to ignore that is to demean those people, but as I say, to demean science. And people have said, and in fact, I think maybe the cardinal may have even talked about scientism, it's a recent word, but I think it's probably worth approaching, that when scientists... And I can say, for me, there's no evidence whatsoever of design or purpose in the universe based on my study of cosmology. That's a fine scientific statement for me to say. But for me to say, therefore there was no design or purpose, that's a metaphysical statement or a philosophical statement that I'm entitled to make, but I'm not being a scientist when I'm making it. And I think we have to recognize that it's beyond the limits of science to go that far. And in fact, as I just say there, and in fact, Andy Drian's here, to quote Carl Sagan, the absence of evidence is not evidence for absence. And he applied it in that case to aliens, I suppose, or something. But it's true. The fact that there's no evidence for design or purpose in the universe is not the same as saying there's no design or purpose. I think the latter statement is a philosophical statement. And actually, Richard Dawkins begins his new book with a quote from Thomas Jefferson, which I like a lot, where he said, I'm satisfied and sufficiently occupied with the things which are, without tormenting or troubling myself about those which may indeed be, but which I have no evidence. Steve put it another way, which I think is equally true. Most scientists don't think enough about God to even call themselves atheists. It's not a question that arises. Why should we trouble ourselves with that? We should trouble ourselves, in fact, with doing science. And here's a statement from the International Theological Commission, a statement actually at the time when Pope Benedict was then a cardinal and head of that commission. And as he stated at the time, as they stated in the sign, they had no problem with evolution because God is the cause of all causes. As a result, through the activity of natural causes, God causes to arise those conditions required for the emergence and support of living organisms, and furthermore for the reproduction and differentiation. A statement where the Theological Commission actually said, as they called contingent phenomena, purely random phenomena, are perfectly in accord with Catholic theology. There's no way that I can see that science can disprove that kind of statement, and it's a waste of time, it seems to me, to try. And totally non-productive. What we should focus on, it seems to me, is the fact that the universe is a remarkable place without all the junk. That only when we're willing to accept the universe for what it is, without fear, will we be able to build a just society. This we'll get on to later tomorrow. Science, we should focus on the fact that science isn't a threat to a moral world. That science has an ethos. And the ethos of science is actually pretty good. It's based on honesty, open-mindedness, creativity, egalitarianism, I would put it anti-authoritarianism, and full disclosure. If any of these things were common, say, in Washington right now, the world would be a better place. And the fundamental thing about science is that it works. And that's what's really important to stress, is that it leads to, in many ways, a better world. It works. It allows us to describe and, in some sense, control the world. And we should recognize that and use that fact. When President Bush said both sides should be taught when it comes to intelligent design and evolution, well, that wasn't an intrinsically stupid statement, surprisingly. If there were two sides, it's a perfectly appropriate statement. It represented ignorance, that there aren't two sides to that scientific argument. But it's amazing, when the avian flu was developed, President Bush immediately said, well, we have to immediately start working about how long it's going to take to mutate and migrate to humans. You didn't see anyone saying, well, it's been designed to kill us. Forget it, you know. Immediately, when there's a problem, people turn to science. And that's what we should be focusing on, the fact that what science can do. And when people talk about family values, we should focus on the fact that the real family values are owing our children the best science preparation, the best education we can give them, so they can compete in the 21st century that's going to depend on our future on science and technology. And finally, I think, I'll just leave it, we should focus on the fact that mysteries, that not knowing is actually a good thing, that not knowing is wonderful, that you don't have to know everything, and the mysteries that science explores are probably the best, and so I'll leave it with the other hero, Albert Einstein, who said, the fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It's the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of true art and true science, and it's the mysterious, I think, and our fascination with the world, which scientists can use to, instead of attack religion, I think encourage people of faith to understand the world that actually is, rather than the world that they would like it to be. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. I don't know if there's anything, Steve, is there anything you want to respond to briefly there? I do remember yesterday you mentioned that you kept running into people who somehow were able to hold these opposing things in their mind. There was an oil man in Texas who...
This is a secondhand story that a friend of mine met in oil man in Texas who believed that the earth was 6,000 years old, because that's what's taught in the book of Genesis, and also believed that the deposits of oil in the Permian Basin were 50 million years old, because that's what you need to know in order to explore for petroleum. And somehow or other he managed this a feat of intellectual acrobatics that I can only admire. I should say, since Larry mentioned that the question of teaching evolution in the schools will come to Texas, of course it already has, and I testified in front of the Texas school board, who has the responsibility of choosing textbooks for the whole state, and some of them were in favor of bringing intelligent design into the textbooks, and others were opposed to it. But I found, interestingly, that the ones who were in favor of bringing intelligent design into the textbooks were very anxious to divorce it from any idea of religion. They said, we just want good science. And that fits in with my remark that there really isn't hostility to science itself in the West, whereas I think there is in the Islamic world. Actually, we won that argument, and evolution without intelligent design as an alternative is what you find in textbooks used in Texas schools. I certainly don't argue that science can disprove the existence of God, and I also wouldn't argue that science can disprove the existence of fairies at the bottom of the garden. It's just after a while, experiencing the world and not seeing any sign of it, you begin to take those ideas less seriously.
One thing I would say to what you said, Steve, is that the very people who were talking to you, and as I unfortunately spent a lot of time with those people who have been pushing intelligent design in the schools, when they say they want to teach just want to teach good science, their definition of good science is very different than yours. And so I think that the supposition that they're not hostile to science is probably naive, I think. I think that they're hostile to the kind of science that you would like to do and that I would like to do.
Well, let's at least say that they don't want to march under the banner of anti-science.
That I think is true, absolutely. And they couch it. But the interesting thing is the very people who couch it as good science there, if you read the internal literature, present those diagrams. Mm. So they're very effective in public relations because most of the public respects science still, although there's been a decline in that if you look at the polls. So I think they're savvy enough to realize that they have to couch their discussion as if they're interested in good science in order to appeal to the voters.
Could I just add another voice to the conversation at this point? You mentioned Richard's book and a couple of quotes there in your Nature review. Richard will be here a little bit later on, but in the interim, perhaps we could add Sam Harris's voice to the conversation. Sam has a book out at the moment called Letter to a Christian Nation, and before that he had a book called The End of Faith. And he's a philosophy graduate, but he's also working on a doctorate in neuroscience at the moment. Sam Harris. Do you have?
I think I have your. You want to one?
Yeah. Well,
no, actually, I'm fine right here.
The podium.
Yeah. I'll take it off.
Anyway. Well, thank you, Roger, and it's really an honor. It's a great honor to be here. I'm afraid I'm going to come down very much on Dr. Weinberg's side in this particular debate, though I found much to agree with in Dr. Krause's remarks. I certainly agree that science is not the enemy of morality, and we have to make that clear in a very public way, and I think our dialogue will go in that direction. It's also not even the enemy of mystery, and I think that is something we'll probably talk about when we talk about if not God, then what. But I'm very much a fan of construing this conflict between religion and science in zero-sum terms, because science is intrinsically the enemy of dogmatism. And there is nowhere in our discourse where dogmatism is more celebrated than in the discourse of religion. So I want to talk about this conflict and why I think it exists and why I think we therefore can't ignore it. But briefly, I want to say a few things about just what I think our situation in the world is, because I really think religion is leading us to the edge of something terrible. And I think if you read the news, if you watch the news, you see that much of the world is over the edge already. 53% of the U.S. population believes that the universe is 6,000 years old and that we have no genetic precursors in the natural world apart from Adam and Eve. There was a study done in 34 countries assessing the level of belief in evolution, and the U.S. came in 33rd, just before Turkey. This is embarrassing. But when you add to this comedy of false certainties the fact that 44% of Americans claim to be confident that Jesus is going to return to Earth in their lifetime, you see a terrible liability of this kind of thinking, because when you look at the prophecies that describe these end of times events, you see that it's not an exaggeration to say that something like half of the American population is eagerly anticipating the end of the world. I think it should be rather obvious that this kind of thinking provides people with no basis to make the hard decisions we have to make to create a durable civilization for ourselves, to make geopolitical and environmental and economic policy that has a time horizon of not 50 years, but thousands of years. Now, many of these people are lunatics, of course, but they are not the lunatic fringe. I mean, we're talking about people who can get Karl Rove on the telephone on a weekly basis, and do on a weekly basis. We're talking about Christian ministers who have congregations numbering in the tens of thousands. We're talking about organizations that have operating budgets in the tens of millions of dollars a year, and in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, whose primary purpose is to spread this ghoulish expectation that the world is soon going to end in glory. We're talking about a group like the Christians United for Israel, which is lobbying the White House and Congress at this moment to take a very hard line with Iran for biblical reasons. Now, it may be that we want to take a very hard line with Iran, but it seems to me rather obvious that we don't want our religious maniacs pushing us there. We're talking about grown men and women with immense political influence who literally believe that a confrontation of this sort would be a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and they expect to be raptured into the sky by Jesus so that they can watch the rest of us hurled into a sea of fire. And yet, if you can imagine it,
I'll explain a little bit more after the break.
The picture is actually much bleaker in the Muslim world. And we are meandering into a global conflict with 1.3, 1.4 billion Muslims, a significant percentage of whom view every political and moral question through the lens of Islam, through in terms of their affiliation with Islam, which is to say they will side with other Muslims no matter how sociopathic their behavior, simply because there are other Muslims in conflict with non-Muslims. Now, there are many well-intentioned people in our society who feel an impulse to apologize for all of this, who think that all of the bloodletting we're witnessing in the Muslim world is a result of the militarism and the incompetence and the greed of our own government. Now, I'm convinced this is a profoundly dangerous misunderstanding of our situation for reasons that I spell out at some length in my first book, The End of Faith. And I'm convinced it's a misunderstanding even if we admit that our war in Iraq has been a catastrophic mistake, as I think it has been. I mean, there's no question we have made enemies in Iraq. But there are enemies there that we have not made, or not merely made. And the enemies we have made, for the most part, we have made by virtue of their theology, by virtue of what they believe about the ascendancy of their faith and the one true way to live on this earth. So this is the situation I think we're in. I think faith is playing both sides of the board in an increasingly dangerous game. And the greatest problem with the rest of us, with secularists and religious moderates and scientists, is that we find it very difficult to believe that people actually believe this stuff. Secularists and religious moderates almost by definition don't know what it's like to be certain of God, to be certain of paradise, to be certain that the book they keep by their bed is the perfect word of the creator of the universe. And therefore they tend to discount the utterances of people who really are certain as propaganda, as behavior that's really a cover for behavior that's being motivated by economics and politics. I mean, I don't know how many more engineers and architects need to fly planes into our buildings before we realize that this is not merely a matter of lack of education or economic despair. So let me speak for a few minutes about how I view the responsibility of science here. It seems to me that the responsibility of science and public intellectuals generally is to be honest. Because this really is a problem of discourse. This is a problem of ideas being systematically sheltered from criticism. So one truth I think in need of telling is this, that there really is a conflict between religion and science, between faith and reason. Because every religion is making claims about the way the world is. These are claims about the divine origin of certain books, about the virgin birth of certain people, about the survival of the human personality after death. These claims purport to be about reality. They are claims about what was and what is and what will be. And this inevitably puts religion on a collision course with science because these are claims made on bad evidence. And we don't have to distinguish hard science and soft science here. I mean, the core of science is not mathematical modeling. It is intellectual honesty. It is a willingness to have our certainties about the world constrained by good evidence and good argument. Now, so science might not encompass all intellectual endeavors, as Lawrence pointed out, but intellectual honesty must. And the problem is not that religious people are stupid. The problem is not that religious fundamentalists are stupid. I happen to think you can be so well educated that you can build a nuclear bomb and still believe that you're going to get 72 virgins in paradise. That is the problem. The problem is that religion, because of it, it's been sheltered from criticism in the way that it has been, allows people, perfectly sane, perfectly intelligent people, to believe en masse what only idiots or lunatics could believe in isolation. I mean, if you wake up tomorrow morning convinced that saying a few Latin words over your breakfast cereal is literally going to turn it into the body of Julius Caesar or Elvis, you have lost your mind. But if you believe that a cracker becomes the body of Jesus at the Mass, you're very likely perfectly sane. You just happen to be Catholic. But that the beliefs really are equivalent, and they are equivalently crazy. So we do not respect stupidity in this country, but we systematically respect religious stupidity. And yet I think there's a basic truth about us that no double standard can erase. Either a person is being intellectually honest, or he isn't. Either a person is willing to look dispassionately at the data, or he's trying to conform the data to his prior conception of the world. And science, when it is working, which is to say when it is really science, amounts to a systematic eschewal of dogma. I mean, dogma in science is humiliating whenever it's recognized to be dogma. Religion really requires the opposite commitment. I mean, consider a few recent statements by the Pope. He recently spoke to a college in Rome where he observed that there were two dangers facing the faithful at this moment in history. The first danger is of a secular society that denies God and thereby, quote, disorients and obfuscates the correct conscience of man. Now, there is an implicit claim being made here, although it's somewhat hard to make out. The claim is that human beings really do get their morality from religion. Religion in this case is Catholicism, obviously. And religion, in some sense, is the only source of real morality. Now, I'm quite convinced that he is wrong about this, and one would have hoped that the legions of child rapists coming out of the priesthood would have given him some pause before making this claim. But I think it is the job of science and of intellectuals generally to really get to the bottom of what morality is, what it is neurologically, what it is demographically, the kinds of social structures that foster it. And I know we'll talk more about this. The Pope also warned against an approach to interfaith dialogue which, quote, weakens the essential content of the Christian faith in Christ as the lone savior of humanity and in the church as the necessary sacrament of salvation for all humanity. Now, there are several claims being made here. One is that faith in Christ is absolutely necessary for salvation. this makes one wonder just where, how far interfaith dialogue can go. But whatever we think of salvation as a concept, this kind of talk proves that the Pope and many millions of Catholics are fundamentally closed to any evidence or argument that suggests what is in fact likely to be true, that Jesus was an ordinary mortal, born of an ordinary act of procreation, and died like any animal. I mean, those facts, would be fundamentally corrosive to the belief system of Christians. So if there were good reasons to believe that Jesus was born of a virgin, or will be coming back to earth to judge the living and the dead, these beliefs would be part of our rational scientific description of the universe. These are claims about physics. These are claims about biology. The only reason why a person needs faith to accept these claims is because the evidence for them is remarkably thin. So I really think it is time we admitted that faith is really the permission that religious people give one another to believe things strongly when reasons fail. I think it's important to point out there is no other area in our discourse where we consider this an acceptable practice. Now, there are, of course, many people who argue that there is no conflict between religion and science. How do they do this? Well, here's how the trick is done. First, they argue that science cannot prove that God does not exist. You know, atheism is a faith. Atheism is the faith that there is no God. Can you prove that Jesus was not the Son of God? Can you prove that he did not rise from the dead on the third day? No. Now, I find it amazing how much work these maneuvers actually do for people. It seems to me that Bertrand Russell, I think as many of you know, closed the door to this kind of thinking for all time with his famous celestial teapot argument. I mean, can we prove that there's not a China teapot in elliptical orbit around the sun at this moment? No. Does it make it reasonable to believe in the existence of such a teapot? No. Is it reasonable to be agnostic about such a teapot? Not quite. End of argument. I mean, it's obvious that the burden is not upon the atheist to prove the absence of celestial teapots. And the real irony here, which I think we have to point out relentlessly, is that every religious person recognizes this with respect to the other guy's religion. I mean, every Christian knows exactly what it's like to be an atheist with respect to Islam. I mean, the Muslims think they have a book, the Quran, which is the perfect word of the creator of the universe. Why do they think so? Because it says so in the book. Not a good argument. Every Christian recognizes this with respect to Islam, but they don't turn the same criticism upon their own discourse. I think we must oblige them to. Now, there's a second trick that purports to reconcile religion and science. And it's one that, quite frankly, has taken in many scientists. So the trick tends to surface whenever a specific piece of scientific data is being talked about and reconciled with religion. In the face of any scientific finding, there are two different questions you can ask. You can ask, does this datum suggest the existence of God? Or you can ask, is this compatible with the existence of God? And these are, they seem similar. They have very different results. Let me take one fact, that 99% of all the species that have ever lived on Earth are now extinct. Does this fact suggest that an omniscient and omnipotent and perfectly benevolent God has designed our world? Not at all. I mean, that's probably the last thing you would infer from such a fact. But ask the other question. Ask, is this fact compatible with the existence of the biblical God? The answer to that question, of course, is yes, and it is always yes. You simply must add caveats like, who can understand the will of God? He may have wanted to destroy his creation for some reason that surpasses our understanding. And of course, you can do this with human events. You look at the Holocaust. Would a reasonable person looking at the Holocaust, at the fact that millions of people were herded into ghettos and terrorized and then murdered and reduced to ash by their neighbors, would you look at that series of events and say, well, there's probably an omniscient and perfectly benevolent and all-powerful God taking an interest in human affairs? You wouldn't. But is it compatible with the biblical God? Of course. You simply must say, God was very pissed off at the Jews, or we have something called free will, and God could not deny the Nazis such a golden opportunity to sin. Who can understand the will of God? As scientists, I think we have to observe that there is a profound difference between acquiring a picture of the world through dispassionate analysis of the facts and acquiring it through patent emotionality and wishful thinking, and then only then looking to see if it can survive contact with the facts. Given the gaps in science and given the elasticity of religious thinking, it will always be possible to reconcile the most gratuitous nonsense with our modern scientific worldview. This is not the same thing as having scientific reasons to believe in God. So in conclusion, I just want to give you a sense of what is motivating these remarks and my participation here at the meeting. Because I'm afraid that we can lose everything we have. I don't just mean personally. I'm talking collectively. I think we can lose a civilization that functions most of the time by the rules of basic human sanity. I mean, you might think we haven't quite achieved that, but maybe we haven't, not quite. But look at how so much of the world lives at this moment. Look at the mayhem born in the name, largely in the name of what people believe about God. I mean, look at what life is like in Iraq and Afghanistan. So much of this world is consumed by violence, and so much of this violence is born of the religious fragmentation of the human community. I mean, the thing that I'm most worried about now is this religious fragmentation and the religious impediments to clear thinking. The religious willingness on the part of millions to rationalize the violent sacrifice of their own children by recourse to fairy tales. And religion allows this. So it just seems to me obvious that the history of our civilization is not yet written, and there is no guarantee that the religious maniacs of the future will not be the ones to write it. Now, in a later session, I plan to talk about ethics and how I view spiritual experience, because I think that these are real domains of inquiry. It's not all just mumbo-jumbo. To say they're real domains of inquiry is to say that they can be explored very much in the spirit of science and without dogmatism. But briefly, I'll just say that the best in us does not require the worst in us. I mean, our love of other human beings does not need to be nurtured by delusion. And yet we are hearing continuously from every corner of our culture that delusion is all we have. Delusion deserves our respect. Delusion is holy. It's not true. Thank you very much.
I have a suspicion that Lawrence Krauss might have something to say about that.
Well, obviously I agree with much of what you said. It's hard not to, but I think the at least as much as concerned. I in this political season have been spending a lot of my time trying to actually affect elections in my own state of Ohio, and by recruiting candidates who believe in science as a useful activity. To take the wonderful example from Bertrand Russell, surely it would be a waste of. The teapot around the sun is an interesting example because it's not worth even talking about, right? Mm. I mean, it would be surely be an incredible waste of scientists' time to spend a lot of their time trying to explain why there wasn't a teapot around the sun. Instead, it would be a remarkably more productive thing to explain exactly how you can predict the motion of the planets around the sun using this law of gravity, and that maybe you can understand the future of the universe and the past and the incredible things you can learn about it. And so the way I'd frame this is that perhaps the best, if you believe that that a rational world is a better world, and I do, and I know you do, that to me, one of the best ways to do that is to demonstrate rationality rather than attacking irrationality. It's important at times to do it, and I've done it. But I think it's much more fruitful in the end to lead by example. That's the argument I think I want to stress.
Yes. Yeah. That's that teapot around the sun again.
Well, I'm not going to defend religion from Sam Harris, but I did want to say a word about American religion. I'm a little bit more sanguine about it than you are. I live in Texas. I have many friends who belong to denominations that officially teach all sorts of things that I find absurd or abhorrent. But when you really talk to them, which is not so often, about what they really think, you find their opinions are much more woolly. And that it may be that 53% or whatever the percent is, when asked in a poll, will say they believe this, that, or the other thing. But when you really get to talk to them, you find their beliefs are not so certain. In particular, many of them believe that many of them belong to religions that officially teach that those who do not accept Christ are doomed to an eternity of torment and hell. And yet I find that they don't try to convert me. I mean, they don't make any attempt to convince me that I'm going to be burned in hell for eternity if I don't join their church. And, of course, one possible theory is that they don't mind if I spend eternity in hell.
They want you to.
But, you know, I'm inclined to think, and I find this in talking to them on the occasions when I can talk to them more seriously, that they're not that certain about it. But I wouldn't say that I'm sanguine about the world of Islam. And the obvious difference is performance. You know, Larry and I and Sam can talk about these things, and we'll even, if anyone ever watches this program, be out there, and Christian Americans will hear us saying these things. And I don't really feel that anyone's going to come after us to cut off our heads. But in the Islamic world, and even in Europe, where there are now a very large number of Muslims, you can't be that secure. I mean, Theo van Gogh was murdered for saying unpleasant things about Islam. And we've seen so many examples of this. So I think, you know, I don't have much respect for religion, but I think it's important to disrespect, not to necessarily disrespect them all equally. In fact, I think this business of respect for religion, and here I'm really just seconding Sam Harris, really is dangerous. I think that it, not only with regard to truth, matters of fact that Sam Harris talked about, but with matters of morality, that the fact that people take their morality from their religion should not necessarily entitle it to respect on our part if, on the basis of our best feelings, it is in fact immoral.
Sam, did you have a...
Him? Sure,
because I
sure.
have one thing I want to say.
Yeah, there are many things. First, let me pick up on what Stephen just said. Clearly, we have to distinguish between specific religious ideologies. I mean, my argument is that specifically what people believe really matters. I mean, it really matters that in Islam at this moment, the doctrines of martyrdom and jihad are highly operative and give a rationale for the kind of behavior, you know, the kind of death cult we see brewing in the Muslim world. And it's not an accident, given the theology of Islam, that that's happening. It is harder to get that kind of behavior off the ground if you're a Buddhist, or even if you're a Christian at this moment in Christian history, given actually specific differences in ideology. So, yeah, I don't think we have to recognize that religion is a word like sport or a word like drug. I mean, there are many different kinds of sports. There are many different kinds of drugs. They don't have necessarily that much in common, and we will, under no circumstances, have a problem with Jain suicide bombers, no matter how we mistreat the Jains. I mean, the Jain religion really is a religion of nonviolence, and the more deranged you get as a Jain, you become less and less violent. So, and there, you know, there are liabilities. The problem with dogmatism, really, I see, is that you almost can never tell how bad its consequences are going to be. I mean, because it's not mapping onto. I mean, dogmas are these beliefs about the world that are not respondent to their consequences in the world and to the streams of evidence and argument that should be modifying them. So you have a dogma like contraception use is immoral, this classically Catholic idea. This seems potentially benign. I mean, it seems like, you know, in the worst case, you're going to get overpopulation. But then you map that onto sub-Saharan Africa, where you have Catholic ministers preaching the sinfulness of condom use in regions of the world where AIDS is epidemic, to people who have no other information about condom use but the representation of the ministry. And so what I've argued elsewhere, this is genocidally stupid, this behavior. And yet, because, as Stephen points out, because it is coming under the aegis of a person's religious conviction, it is immune to the kind of criticism that we would normally marshal against it. And the one other thing I'd like to say, I think that Dan Dennett would say if he were here, is that, yes, there probably is some distance between what people actually believe and what they profess to believe. I mean, you know, we have these astonishing poll results, and then we have to ask ourselves, well, how many people are really sure that Satan exists and leads people to sin, as something like 70% of the American population claims to believe? I just think you have to, you know, you cut the poll number in half or in a third. I mean, there's some core people who are really sure. And in the Muslim world, there's absolutely no possibility of doubting this, because they simply blow themselves up in front of the offices of the UN or the Red Cross to announce their certainty. And this is so I think the idea that no one's sure, I think, is
I just want to say one thing. I know you want to move on, but it relates to the two things that have just been said. The willingness that Steve talked about, which is certainly real, I think reflects a more general willingness that's based on illiteracy, in particular literacy of scientific illiteracy. There's another poll number that is equally maybe more disturbing to me than the ones about evolution. That comes from National Science Foundation studies that are done each year of scientific literacy. And every single year since it's been done, 50% of the American public get the answer to this question wrong. Does the Earth orbit the sun and take a year to do it? Okay, 50% of the American public don't believe the Earth orbits the sun and takes a year to do it, at least in the survey. Every single year. Now, I know who they voted for, but that's a different issue. The point is that I'm not sure if you really confronted them about this that they'd really believe that the sun went around the Earth. But that woolliness, that really fundamental misunderstanding about nature, that ignorance is what, to me, allows a lot of the dogma to result. And so it seems to me that the real villain here is ignorance. And the best way to overcome ignorance is to teach. And that when you have a more literate and particularly scientifically literate public, I happen to believe that it will be much more difficult for a lot of the things that you fear and I fear to happen.
Right. Well, I agree. Let me just say, however, that I'm not. The basis for being totally sanguine on that front is rather narrow when you notice people like Francis Collins. I mean, how much more science does Francis Collins need to have on board before he doubts that Jesus is the Son of God, likely to return to save humanity? I mean, this is, you know, as many of you, I think, know, he's written this book, The Language of God. It purports to reconcile evangelical Christianity with the last 50 years of molecular biology. When you get to the point in the book where he had his doubts about Jesus removed, you come upon a passage, the anthropic principle and other things are in there, but when you get to the nuts and bolts of why he's sure of Jesus, you get to a moment where he was hiking in the Cascade Mountains and came upon a frozen waterfall. It was beautiful. He fell to his knees in the dewy grass and gave himself to Christ. Now, I would argue that if a frozen waterfall can testify to the truth of Christian doctrine, it can testify to anything. And this is not scientific thinking, and it gets a pass. I mean, it is impolitic for me to perhaps be saying this. And I would, you know, I would love to be in dialogue with Francis directly about this, but it is this kind of thinking comes at a great price in our society, because it is now imagined that you can be rigorously scientific on every question and be certain, based on a frozen waterfall, that Jesus is the sole savior of humanity. And I think that's quite dangerous when we have a president who uses his first veto to block stem cell research, for instance.
Yeah, a couple of points there, Sam. One is that Francis Collins actually was invited. They invited him twice, and he's got an intramural meeting that he's actually chairing. So he sent his apologies. He would have liked to have been here. There was a debate at Time Magazine's offices between Richard Dawkins and Francis Collins, which I believe is the subject of the next Monday's Time Magazine. Richard, I guess, will be able to tell us about it when he gets here. Secondly, Dan Dennett, those of you who didn't know, had a serious heart issue a couple of weeks ago. He's fine now. He's back at writing vibrant and wonderful articles, one of which will be read by Paul Churchland later on. And Dan sends his best wishes as well. A lot of people, in fact, who were invited will be coming to, I hope will be coming to the one that they are missing, but we did invite Ed Wilson, and he said that he would love to come, but he was trying to reduce his schedule from insane to merely frantic. So he can't be with us either, but again sends his best wishes. We're about 15 minutes behind, but what I would still like to do, given the way the conversation has gone, I was hoping to establish some sort of grounding in this session. What I'd like to do is to have Michael Shermer just do a quick talk on sort of categories. I think this will help put us in, get things sorted out after these first three talks into where the debate is on this particular part of the issue. And then we'll take a break, and the panelists will still be here. The four of them will be here, and we'll start adding others. Neil Tyson has arrived, and Neil Tyson will come up and talk after the break as well, and other people who will be surprised. So I think Michael Shermer, if you're ready. Michael is the founding director and publisher, founding editor and publisher of Skeptic magazine. He's also a former college professor. He wrote a nice biography of Alfred Russel Wallace, and his latest book is Why Darwin Matters, The Case Against Intelligent Design. Michael Shermer.
Thank you, Roger. Good to be here, everybody. If I'm moving a little slow, I threw my back out this week, and just as I was getting better, I brought three cases of Skeptic magazine to give everybody, and that threw it out again this morning. So, but no worries, because, you know, we study chiropractic, and I've learned how to do it myself. So I'll just show you a little thing here. Much better.
You see, there is a God, Michael.
My headache's gone. I was trying to think of a little anecdote that would be appropriate. Huh?
Can you do that again? No, please. I don't want to see it.
Hang on. Let me see if they have any. They have any cups here. You're not supposed to show the reveal, but a little plastic cup goes a long ways for doing some simple magic tricks. Don't tell Randy I did that, because I'm only an amateur. I really did throw my back out, though. That's not funny. Well, I was trying to think of an anecdote appropriate for today, and I was on a book tour for my new book, Why Darwin Matters, on the East Coast last week, and a funny thing happened to me. I had a couple hours before my evening talk, and I went for a little walkabout. This was in Philadelphia. I thought I'd go to see that Muter Museum that has all the old weird medical oddities from the 19th century. So I exited the hotel, one of these multi-story hotels, and I started down the sidewalk, and I was wearing this suit. And it turns out, back in January, we were in Las Vegas for the big Randy conference, the amazing meeting. And one night we went to see the Penn & Teller show, the magician's Penn & Teller, and they end the show with this terrific double bullet catch, where Penn's on one side, Teller's on the other side. They each shoot these 357 magnums which the bullets go through, plate glass, pieces of glass there. The bullets themselves have been signed by two volunteers, the casing and the bullet, and then you can see when the volunteers look at the two bullets that have crossed the stage, the one bullet is now in his mouth, the other bullet's in his mouth. And I got to be one of the volunteers for this, and it was pretty cool. My bullet that I put little MS on there actually ended up on the other side of the stage. I don't know how they did it. All I know is that they didn't actually shoot it and catch it. We know that much, but it's a good trick. Anyway, I got to keep the bullet, and I had put the bullet in this pocket. So now months later, I exit the room, and I'm walking out of the hotel, and I hear this noise, and I look up, and there's a crazed evangelist who has heaved a Gideon's Bible out of the room, and it's hurtling toward me, and I duck, and the Bible struck me right in the chest. And that Bible would have gone right through my heart if it weren't for that bullet. So, not sure the relevance of that.
I like it, though. That's good.
Mostly made-up story. Miracles do occur. Well, I've written many times about this kind of three-tiered model that I put together when I originally wrote Why People Believe Weird Things, and I've just sort of applied it in various books. That is, what is the relationship of science and religion? Just roughly speaking, there's the sort of conflicting worlds model, same worlds, so they're in conflict, same worlds model, and then the separate worlds model. So largely what we've heard so far and will hear will fall into one of these three categories. Obviously, there's subtle differences, but just as a working model, it helps us to get our minds around this. So in the same worlds model, it's the idea is that science and religion are just two different ways of looking at the same reality, and therefore we should have sort of mutual respect for them. Somebody like contemporary times here, Owen Gingrich's book, God's Universe, and perhaps Francis Collins' book, would be in this category. They're completely friendly to science. They accept all the findings of science, and they feel that the science just illuminates what they already believe. In my opinion, in virtually every case, these are instances of people that already believe for other reasons, and then they use the findings of science to support what they already believe. And that's almost always the case, because the reason people believe anything usually has to do more with psychology and sociology and how you were raised and the emotional impact and importance of the belief, and then you back into it with rational arguments after the fact. That's what most of us do most of the time, politically, economically, ideologically, in every which way, including religion. So that's the same worlds model. The conflicting worlds model, which is held by virtually all of my atheist friends and fundamentalist Christian friends, is that one of them is right and the other one's wrong, depending on the particular thing you're talking about, and therefore you really need to pick one. One of them's right and the other one's wrong. And then finally, the third separate worlds model, this would be best supported, I suppose, by Steve Gould's NOMA idea, non-overlapping magisteria, that they're really two different things, like plumbing and baseball or something. They just have nothing to do with one another. And so, therefore, they can't be in conflict. I guess, we can just sort of think about that heuristic as we hear different views. I think the answer, it depends in large part on what your goal is. I've been thinking about this a lot lately because since I'm in the business and I read all these books, I find myself in agreement with almost everybody. And how can that be? You have to be one of these tiers, don't you? And I think it depends on what your goal or purpose is. If you feel like, say, Sam does, that religion is really a dangerous social force that could bring down the demise of Western civilization, something like that, then the idea that, well, we should make nice because we want to teach good science and we want everybody to embrace science and so we should be polite to religious people, well, that's sort of irrelevant if you think your larger goal here is I'm going to save Western civilization because look what the people that, like terrorists can do to us. So you would then pick which of these categories or which attitude you want to take toward religion depending on what your purpose is, what's your goal, what are you trying to accomplish. So when I read like Dawkins' book, I can't find much that I disagree with it at all, and yet I would never take that approach. And why is that? And because I think I have a different goal. It depends on what your goal is. If your goal is to talk religious people out of their beliefs, that would be one form of strategy. You would take a certain strategy to do that. If your goal is something else, then maybe that wouldn't work. I'm not saying this very well, but so let me back into it in a slightly different way. If your goal is to lead a rational, logical life, that is, you want to use science and reason and rationality and logic and so on to derive your ideas, to try to understand how the world works, and you want to apply this across the board to everything you do, including the derivation of your ideas, but more than that, how you act in the world. If you have derived certain ideas based on science and reason, and then you apply behavioral methods that do just the opposite of what your goals are, which I contend most contentious attitudes toward religion will do just the opposite of what most people claim they want to do, that it's not just that, well, you're not making nice, or, you know, you should really sacrifice your principles in this particular instance because we have some other goal. That isn't the reason, or we want to promote science education. That isn't the reason. It's that you're actually being irrational if you're doing something that does not accomplish your goal, that actually interferes with your goal. So you have to apply rationality, reason, logic, science, whatever, to all aspects of your life. And if you're going to do that, then you have to set your goals and determine, well, is it social context, social intelligence, social skills, emotional intelligence, how you interact with other people matters every bit as much as how you derive the age of the earth or whatever particular doctrines you believe. I saw this example. I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a libertarian, which is like herding cats in an election, next to impossible. And I've been that way my whole life. And libertarians have the same problem, which is where I learned this principle, was that they're so fanatically focused on particular doctrines that you have to believe if you want to be considered a libertarian, that they exclude almost all other libertarians.
Waiting to see what's
so almost
happening.
Nobody's a member of the group, which, you know, talk about small tents. And so people like Ayn Randians, objectivists who are also atheists, would go around like assaulting people that wore crosses because they believe in God. And it's like, okay, but wait a minute. I thought your purpose was here. We want to have a liberal democracy and a free market, and we want to promote these ideas of economic freedom. When you assault somebody's religiosity, how is that accomplishing this other goal? In fact, it's going to do just the opposite. So in that sense, they're being irrational, and I claim so are depending on what your goal is. If your goal is let's just be blunt. Let's say I'm pissed off about religion, and I want to get in people's face and tell them that I think you're being irrational, and you're an idiot. You're a moron to believe this stuff. Okay, if that's your goal, then by all means, go for it. But what will that actually accomplish? And what are your goals anyway? So that, I think, helps us kind of set the stage for what it is we're trying to accomplish. I think Darwin said this well. I take two sources for this. The first, the great libertarian writer, Ludwig von Mises, wrote in the 1950s against his fellow anti-communists, that being an anti-communist is completely against what it is we're trying to do. It just virtually advertises the position we're against. You can't be against something. You have to be for something. And until you're for something, we're not going to accomplish any goals. And Darwin said something along the same line, since his name will be invoked throughout this weekend. I thought I'd read just a short section from my book about his own beliefs. He was a creationist when he was in the Galapagos. He was a creationist when he left the Galapagos. He was a creationist until he got home and started thinking about this. It's too hot and miserable in the Galapagos to do any theorizing, as I discovered. So, and we also know he wasn't an evolutionist in the Galapagos because he didn't even record the islands from which he got the different specimens. In fact, they stored hundreds of tortoises in the bowels of the beagle and ate the data on the way home and threw the carapaces overboard. If you're an evolutionist, you need to record, because of the principle of adaptive radiation, you need to record where all these different specimens came from. So, but later, because of the evil nature of the predator-prey relationships, the death of his daughter and other things, he lost his religiosity and never wrote about it publicly ever. We know what his beliefs were, however, from private letters. In 1879, just 3 years before he died, Darwin finally expressed his beliefs. In my most extreme fluctuations, I've never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. I think that generally, and more as I grow older, but not always, that an agnostic would be the more correct description of my state of mind. Here he's using Huxley's meaning that it's not that we're waiting for more data. It could go this way, it could go that way. It's that there'll never be any data. There'll never be some experiment. Science can't adjudicate the problem. Just simply without, it's beyond the realm of science. That's what Huxley meant, and that's what Darwin means here. A year later, Darwin clarified his thinking. The British socialist Edward Aveling had compiled a volume entitled The Student's Darwin on the Implications of Evolutionary Theory for Religious Thought. And Aveling wanted Darwin's endorsement. But, you know, like a little blurb on the back, you know, that you get from like that. The book had a militant anti-religious flavor and unabashedly radical atheist tone that Darwin disdained. And he declined the request, elaborating his reason with his usual flair for quotable maxims. Quote, "It appears to me, whether rightly or wrongly, that direct arguments against Christianity and theism produce hardly any effect on the public, and freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds, which follows from the advance of science. It has, therefore, always been my object to avoid writing on religion, and I have confined myself to science." He then appended an additional hint about a personal motive, noting, quote, "I may, however, have been unduly biased by the pain which would have given some members of my family if I aided in any direct attacks on religion." Darwin's wife, Emma, was a deeply religious woman, and out of respect for her, he kept the public side of his religious skepticism in check, an admirable feat of self-discipline by a man of high moral character. So in that sense, we see Darwin chose as his goal domestic tranquility, I suppose, or respect out of his love for his wife versus doing something that would largely have no effect in any case, that is, attack religion and get in people's faces. And so it depends on that, on what your purposes are. And finally, a couple final comments. There's so much to say on the subject, and I guess we will for the next several weeks, but when you talk about it, religion, I think it's good if we define what it is we mean when we're talking about that. It's such a huge subject, the topic of why are people religious or not. It can't be answered unless you define what it is you're talking about. And so, I mean, faith, belief in God, which aspects of religion? Obviously, religiously driven terrorists, bad. But what about the hundreds of millions, even perhaps over $1 billion raised just for Katrina by religions? Religion did way more than certainly the government did. And there are no scientific organizations rushing to help the victims of Katrina. Of course, because that's not what science does. So are you talking about that when you're talking about religion? What exactly are we talking about? So in behavioral science and psychology, when you run an experiment, you have to have a criteria, some objective definition of what it is you're measuring when you're trying to measure something in a very specific way, rather than just something global, which we tend to do when we talk about religion. I think part of the problem in the approach, if your goal is to, I guess, talk people out of their religion, or at least get them to embrace science and the liberal values. Let's say your goal, like our goal at the Skeptic Society, is to spread liberal democracy, reason, rationality in as many places as possible. That's sort of our rough goal. And science and reason, we think, is the best tool for doing that. If you give a person a choice between, say, Darwin and the theory of evolution, in particular, and science in general, and his religion, which for those of us who are not religion, we think of as, not religious, we think of as, oh, it's these silly beliefs about the cracker becomes the body and the resurrection, and this is all baloney. Surely anybody would give up this nonsense for this grand science stuff. I mean, the Hubble Space Telescope photographs of the expanding universe. I mean, this is terrific. How can you accept the silly old nonsense? Because that's not why people are religious. What you're really asking them to do is give up their family, their friends, their social circle, their community, their social life, virtually every aspect of your life. Think of the scale. Darwin and science over here and my family, my friends, my social circle, the bowling league, everybody I work with, everybody in the community I know. You want me to give up that? Forget it. I'm not going to do it. They won't even get past the first paragraph of your book because they're not interested in giving all that stuff up. So there has to be another way around it. And the approach I've taken here, again, it's not just making nice to, just to make for nice sake. It's to accomplish a goal. That is, you don't have to give up anything. You can embrace all of the findings of science. If you believe that God is eternal, what difference does it make whether he did it 6,000 years ago or 6 billion years ago? It's just six zeros, nine zeros, 12 zeros, 100 zeros. If you're eternal, it doesn't matter. I've tried this. These are approaches I've tried on my Christian friends, and so far it works pretty well. And if you believe God is the creator of all things and he's omniscient, omnipotent, what difference does it make how he did it? You know, spoken word, lightning bolt out of the finger, natural selection, gravity. I mean, nobody uses this argument anymore. I'm amazed that intelligent design creationists haven't found this quote from Isaac Newton at the end of his Principia Mathematica. Newton couldn't figure out why the planets are all in the plane of the ecliptic, all going in the same direction, spinning in the same direction. So he wrote, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Why doesn't anybody make that argument anymore? Because we now have a perfectly good theory about how the planetary systems are formed. And so now what believers say is, well, yeah, of course, but that's the way God creates solar systems. He gets condensing clouds of hydrogen gas and gravity and so on. That's how he did it. Why can't you just say God used evolution to create the moral sentiments? That's where we get the moral law that C.S. Lewis talks about that Francis Collins leans so heavily on. Why not just say, well, God used evolution. That's the way he did it. At some point, of course, my really militant atheist friends who really want to push the ontological question, yeah, but what place for God then? Well, it comes down to this, that if God is operating in the world, then it's legitimate for us to ask how he's doing it. That is, can we measure it or something like that? So the only place for God really is beyond space and time, that is beyond the natural world. So there can be no conflict. It has to be separate worlds. There can be no conflict. A is A. A cannot be non-A. The natural cannot be the supernatural. If God is entering into our world, then he's really just part of the world, and therefore part of science, and therefore part of the natural world. And if he's not, then he's outside of it, and that's how you keep them separate. What you decide to do with that when you engage a believer, it depends on your goals. And I think that's where it comes down to, I think, in terms of where we're going to go with this conference this weekend. It'd be interesting to know, what is your purpose? What is your goal in studying this? And what are you trying to accomplish when you engage a believer or a non-believer? We have some believers here in terms of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Given the fact that it's now 12 o'clock, we'd like to take a break for 15 minutes. It'll give us a chance to think about a few questions. These people will all be here, and Michael. Richard Dawkins is here. We'll probably get some food, and we'll then be refreshed, and we'll probably have something to say about